You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode of the Made of Clay Report is Steve Felker. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Eric. How are you?
I'm good. The big question, who are you? And the purpose of that is just, how do we start a conversation with somebody we don't necessarily know? Though you and I know each other a bit.
Yeah.
But the idea of the show is to get to know each other across our differences. And so we start with a big question. Who are you?
Who are you? Where do you even begin with a question like that? A disciple of Jesus Christ. And that goes back to my high school time. And maybe we'll get into some of that transitional sure. period of my life at some point. Husband of one. Married a lovely woman, Gail. And father of four. And grandfather of one.
Uh-huh.
Enjoying immensely my time as the senior pastor at Christ Chapel, where I've been for over 15 years now. Up on the northeast corner, and my hobby is with the Cayuga Heights Fire Department, if I can express it that way.
Sure.
And have been an interior firefighter and apparatus operator with the Heights for a while now. Joined in 2003, so that's been a bit of a tenure there, and just enjoy that a great deal.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. Those are probably a few of the pieces. You have to start picking it apart from there.
Okay. No, but also, I mean, what you just described are two major families.
Yeah.
Your church Three. Family. Your biological.
And the expanding biological one.
Yeah, and a church family, but also being a volunteer firefighter for many people, many volunteer firefighters don't even have church memberships because the role in the volunteer firefighting is a huge community for those people.
It is. It's also a huge commitment.
Yeah.
And we can even roll back up through some of the involvements that is, but increasingly in our regulated times, the demands in terms of training and the demands in terms of commitment just continue to escalate, but people's free time doesn't.
Right.
And so it'd be an interesting thing to see where that particular structure of our society goes long term, because it's we're progressively making it more and more untenable for people to volunteer because the demands for training to be an effective volunteer on the one front are only escalating, but the demands of life and keeping right, up with taxes right. and mortgages and car payments and all the rest are also escalating, and something's going to get pinched.
Right, right. And we
hence
have,
the end of the ambulance in Slaterville.
Right, 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 right. And that's a larger conversation about what we do with our unpaid labor and our volunteer time,
yeah.
which is another huge one. You brought some music with you. And so you wanted to start with Chuck Mangione, Feels So Good. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, just let it roll.
Okay, we're going to do that.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Steve Felker. So, Steve, given who you are now, what were some of the experiences that you had that you look back on that really have kind of given your life some texture, some meaning, some direction?
You know, too often our texture meaning is brought through some negative experiences, but I love to look back and see the hand of God in those as well. You know, but a lot of my texture is just drawn from family. Uh-huh. Rich, solid, stable family, good connections with extended family, parents who just really modeled so much good virtue, love, generosity, dedication. And so I'd say that'd be the first stop in terms of identifying the shaping and the formation of things.
And those are skills that are born of having lived through some conflict and some crises. And
in their lives, for sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, both my parents were World War II generation, and my mom from southern Pennsylvania, but my dad just across the border from here, maybe within the reach of the radio station in Montrose, Pennsylvania. the family farm is still there, still in the family, and that's got to be 160-170 years running now. Wow. It's a dad's cousin owns it, and we do family reunions down there still, and I've got family kind of throughout the region up in my mom's side has some roots with the Van Patten clans up around Preble and Tully and those areas. So yeah, I'd never been to Ithaca until I came to the church here, but we pretty well had it surrounded. But all that family pours into who you are.
Sure.
My dad was a mid-level executive with GE, so he would get promoted and we would move, and that kind of made me the I-90 brat from Syracuse to Erie to Schenectady.
Right.
And but some of the timing and some of those journeys were important. So during the time in Erie, we had Chuck Mangione on, and I'm a horn player, or at least used to be, not so much anymore.
But was
part of a high school with a tremendous music program, and we competed nationally in the marching band competitions at Whitewater, Wisconsin. And during my years, we were fifth in the nation.
Wow.
Fielding in the unlimited class, we'd put over 200 people on the field and try and keep all that together. And that was just, those were just extraordinary experiences of team building, of unity, of being part of something bigger than yourself. And that also became the seedbed of a giant spiritual transformation for me, in the sense that you know, we took this national competition, took fifth my junior year of high school, and the only other guy better than me in my class in the band was being groomed for drum major, which meant all the best solos were going to be mine. And so, you know, for a high schooler's ego, I was in a great place. I was looking forward to a senior year that was going to probably be disastrous, but you never quite know how that's going to roll. When my dad, out of his dedication to family, came home and announced we were moving. GE was going through another reorganization. He was in finance, which is the one department that never earns the company money.
Right.
So it's always the first to get cut and transitioned and to end up having to do even more work with fewer people.
Right.
And concluded that if that happened, he wasn't going to be home enough to see his kids, of which I was the oldest. And that he was going to pull a job change instead, happened to land parallel within the same company. But the summer before my senior year of high school, we moved out of state to another state, to a school that did not have a marching band.
Wow.
To a school who the band director's son was in my class and was the lead trumpet. And you're not going to compete with that as a new kid on the block.
Right.
And basically everything that was my values, everything that was my identity, everything that defined me was stripped away.
I get it.
That was a void space for sure.
And your senior year, I mean, it's your last.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, so you're not making any friends in your new high school because they've already had their friends for 4 years.
Right.
All my friends were 2 years younger than me because my class was everybody real, had already set their social,
right,
except for some folks you didn't want to hang with, because there were some people who will, if you will smoke this or drink this or take this with us, you can hang with us. And I didn't want to get into that particular lifestyle. And so that became for me a huge season of destabilization and searching. Now, my family had a you know, a strong Christian life and practice and heritage. But that became the season when I had to wrestle with my own issues of identity for myself. And that pressed me to really take stock. And in that season, took stock and claimed my faith from my own instead of sitting on my parents' coattails.
Right. So what does taking stock look like for a 17-year-old?
You know, I think in that case, you know, you're stripped of friends. You're utterly lonely. Every orientation you kind of had for your life is disassembled for you over the course of a summer and the following fall semester. And I just think at that time it was like, well, time to hang on to something that lasts, not something that can be lost. I don't know. You know,
So that was a long time ago.
Yeah,
and what I'm 40 years ago. So what I'm asking is, who did you talk to? What did you look to?
In reality, I fell back to. In high school in Erie, we had an exceptional pastor in the church. Uh-huh. And my parents, I think, in retrospect, made the church choice based on how their kids resonated with the church and the pastor, not whether it was what they wanted. Which was an interesting thing.
But that was a really wise choice in those years.
Oh, it really was. And so Dave Schieber at Elmwood United Presbyterian Church in Erie, Pennsylvania, was in some ways a big kid. But he was also one of those infinite energy people. Mm-hmm. And he just engaged us. He empowered us. Mm-hmm. He showed us a life of faith that wasn't stuffy.
Right.
That was lived large. I don't know how he got along with his board, but he sure got along with us kids as the senior pastor of that church. He went on actually to go plant a church, I think in Louisville or Knoxville. I can't remember which. Advent Presbyterian down there. He's since retired. But he left that impact. And so I think when the voices of your staff that have been static in your life are stripped away and your distractions are stripped away, mm-hmm. it's the foundational pieces that you go back to. Those are the voices still speaking at the time.
So you were engaging him in your head and in your heart.
Yeah, I would say more in the heart than the head even at that point because, my gosh, you're entering in cold into this whole new environment. There's not time to think. It's much more reactive than proactive. Yeah. But that was the season. That was part A of the season, the deepening of my faith.
Right.
The second aspect of that was I was a math science kid. I have a strong mechanical inclination. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work, I'll figure out how to make it work, and I'll make it work better probably than it did first time around. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's like, this kid's an engineer. And I was like, yep, sure, you betcha.
Right.
So I was steering that direction whole hog, as little of the liberal arts as I could possibly take and graduate from high school, and just decided I really wanted to head down that road. I mean, I took and stripped down a dilapidated old Volkswagen Beetle, and rebuilt the thing from the ground up, sold it for a nice profit, and that's how I funded my honeymoon. I mean, I'm that kind of guy, you know. Second semester senior year of high school, I'd already been accepted at one of the top engineering schools in the country, Grove City College, a Christian school in Western Pennsylvania. They still have a very distinguished engineering program, but this is now 30 years ago. Accepted early decision. It was all set. All good to go. This is going to be awesome. Can't wait to get back to Western Pennsylvania because that's where I'd been in high school in Erie.
Right.
And in fact, it turned out some of my classmates from there also had gotten into Grove City, and we reconnected when I got there.
Uh-huh.
I was really looking forward to going back home more or less in reality from the life we had briefly in the Capital District. I had briefly in the Capital District. My dad retired from there. Second semester, senior year of high school, it was as if God reached into my head and flipped the switch and shut off math.
Huh.
All the advanced mathematics I was doing just suddenly became an abject mystery to me.
Huh.
Bless my teachers, they gave me gratuitous D's and let me graduate. But that
in high school or
high school in high school. So that became a season of soul searching now, because here I am, and that freight train coming is leaving to go to college to enter an engineering program, looking at myself and saying, if you couldn't do it in high school, how are you going to do it in college? Oh dear. And arriving at Grove City going, what am I going to do? You know, freshman orientation's going on. And I'm a non-reflective sort. I'm a forward looker, not a backward looker by nature. So get there and going through freshman orientation, and that hour is coming when you have to choose your classes. And knowing that I'm really up a creek if I try the engineering path at this point. What am I going to do with this? And some upperclassmen were saying, you know, there's this guy here, Mr. Bibza, and he does this New Testament survey class that's just amazing. If you ever can take this class, you guys, you really, really should take this class, because he's just incredible. But you can't take it unless you're an upperclassman or a religion major. Being a person who naturally falls into the path of least resistance, it's like, hey, okay, I guess I'll just become a religion major, because this sounds like an interesting class to take.
Right. The forward thinking, the forward looking problem solving.
And it was about that reflective.
Yeah.
And that started a whole new career path that had not been on my radar whatsoever.
Neat.
Entered into that. There was a gal who had been part of our church in Erie when I was in high school, and we had visited. Pastor Sheber had taken all of us down to Grove City because it was the same denomination school, and she gave us sort of the student's tour, not the official tour of the campus. Right. I fell in love with the place right there. My parents still made me look at Lehigh and RPI and all those other schools that I had already made my decision, but you have to make your parents happy sometimes. Right. So we went and did the tours anyway. And so Joanne connected me with a group called Gospel Team, which is a campus to church ministry thing on campus. We would go into churches and do their services for them, and it would sell the school a little bit. And we had about a 30 voice choir that we would bring, and some of the upperclassmen would take up the preaching duties on behalf of the pastor, and, you know, kind of give the pastor, and just be a treat for the church that way, and became a part of that. Did my minor in counseling while there, doing the religion major, and really laid a great seedbed to head on to grad school, and did seminary at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that was just a really rich experience. In between in there, married Gail, who I met, and we traveled with Gospel Team together. Mm-hmm. And it was very good. So anyway, that was a neat, very formative period of life, a great and empowering section of the journey.
Mm-hmm. Neat. Let's cut to music. Well, actually,
you're gonna do some little music. How about Grover Washington's Body and Soul? Sounds fine.
Okay, good.
I like Grover. I love a jazz saxophone, I gotta tell you.
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Steve Felker.
Good to be with you again.
Good. So Steve, what has defined how you've viewed ministry, how you've lived ministry, and how has your call played out?
Oh, man, how does it play out? It's played out a host of ways, but... you know, just the growth of actually getting married and merging your life to another person, that begins to shape you there, you know. You find out the kind of person you are and the kind of person you aren't. And I would say that's probably been the biggest piece of growth for me is becoming mm-hmm. the husband to Gail. Because, you know, you're always becoming. I will always be becoming the husband of my wife, right. as long as we have life together. So that has shaped becoming a father. We miscarried our first two kids and experienced, you know, the fear and the grief that goes with that. Will we ever have kids and some of those kinds of things. Right. And one of those occasions transpired as I was wrapping up seminary and was actually in New York State here on internship. The second happened when we got to our first parish call in western Kansas. So the first church I served was out north of Dodge City, about 40 miles. It was 40 miles to the grocery store and 60 miles to the hospital where the first of our children was born. And very small, very tight community, but a beautiful place to cut your teeth in ministry because you learn to do ministry in community. Yep. If there's a knock on seminaries, and I think that they've improved a lot in the last 35 years, but in my day, if there was a knock on seminaries, it was that they were very intellectually focused and very and really lacking in terms of relational and communal right. focus. Right. It was preparing you to be a seminary professor, not preparing you to love and serve people in communities. And so I think being there that way and being plunged into a community where there was no place to hide
right, right.
was just a great space. So we had a glorious 5 years there, two kids there, and then a call came to Western Massachusetts near Great Barrington in the beautiful Berkshire Mountains, a church that had been established in 1794. And it was grown out of a church up the road that was established in 1744 and was no longer in business. So we had all the archives there. Wow. So, you know, to be able to hold and read through documents like that. But again, it was another small community. And that was the place where, well, let me back up to Kansas for a minute because that's where a real formative element of ministry happened. So in a small community like a rural community in Kansas, Hanston, Kansas. They made the cover of Sports Illustrated once, but anyway, folks can go chase that one down. The title of the article is Eight is Enough. But anyway, go find it. In Hanston out there, you do a lot of other things as a pastor. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, I brought my engineering impulses to bear, working part-time with a carpenter, working part-time with a guy who had all three master's licenses, plumbing, electrical, and HVAC, helping and working with farmers in the community who at times just needed that extra person.
Hands, yeah, absolutely.
And it was one of those days. It was like an April spring day where the sun was hot, but the ground was cold and damp. Helping a farmer work some cattle. And it was calves, and so somebody has to take their temperatures, and if it's above a certain level as they're coming into the medicine shed for their vitamins and stuff like that, you put an X on the forehead if they're a fever, if it's above a certain point.
Right.
You know, cattle don't appreciate that temperature probe.
I'm sure they don't. Yes, I know they don't.
And a 400-pound calf doesn't enjoy that very much and knows how to tell you so in the chute. And so I was just having one of those miserable moments. You know, Lord, I went to one of the finest colleges in the country. You know, Lord, I went to one of the finest seminaries in the country. Lord, I'm better than this. This is a waste of my life. What am I doing out here shoving a cattle probe up a cow's butt? And I won't say it was audible, but the Lord brought those words to me from Matthew 20, verse 28. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve.
Uh-huh.
And that was a firm rebuke that shaped the trajectory of my ministry by giving it a purpose and a focus where that my eyes were not on me but were elsewhere.
Right.
So fast forward into Massachusetts.
Before you fast forward, I want to stop. One of the things that we often don't appreciate is people have to complain until they realize they don't have to complain anymore.
Well, the biblical model of lament is a big piece of that. But in the midst of lament...
But you weren't lamenting, you were complaining.
Yeah, well, I was both. Probably both at that point.
Well, yeah.
So getting into Massachusetts, the church was across the street from the little firehouse there.
Yeah.
And I'd hear the siren go off and sit there. And it seemed like an awful long time, observing from the church office, before somebody would come screeching in and then the ambulance would go tearing out or something like that. It dawned on me, and I'd already kind of made an acquaintance with the chief, who was also the police chief, and he'd been, come on, you need to join. And finally, it was like, you know, I could make a difference here. Mm-hmm. And so went ahead and joined the fire department there, and served for 8 years within the 9 years there that I was the pastor of that mm-hmm. church, growing in that department, getting equipment on the road a whole lot quicker.
Right.
In a community that was very spread out, a lot of square miles in that southwestern Massachusetts mountainous territory with a thin population. And that really became a way to just commit to a community and to be a servant within mm-hmm. the community that way, and really enjoyed that, and so that was a transitional thing to really get my feet on the ground that way in terms of serving and making a difference and having an impact with people in those kinds of communities. A lot of times we were the only church. I was the only resident pastor, so you become in essence the community pastor.
Right.
Even if they never darkened the doors of the church, when there was the crisis, the funeral, the wedding,
Right. You
got the call and you got to have an impact and make a difference at some level in a particular life that way. You would also, because of the fire department, you'd get rolled into people's tragedies.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, those are their own, you know, being pulled into other people's traumas are their own transformational moments that you experience with the firefighter side of the thing. And we have a whole arena of conversation called critical incident stress and critical incident stress debriefing within the fire service and the professional emergency services that's not widely known but hugely important.
Yeah, and I'm gonna put a picture frame around something mm-hmm. right here, and that is many pastors have learned, as you have learned, that you need to be outside the pastoral role sometimes to mm-hmm. serve, mm-hmm. which means as a firefighter, you're just dressing up and going out and working with everybody else, and you're just one of the firemen. Yeah. And that is a wonderful place for people to see pastors, ministers, because they oftentimes assume that they're on an ego trip.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily so.
In fact, I find that it's very rarely so. And whether it's somebody just kind of carrying the freight in a nonprofit board on the side, or being involved in some community organization, or being engaged off the radar, so to speak, with a tutoring thing or a jail visitation thing. There's just a whole host of those sorts of things. But I know very few pastors who are strictly dialed into the four walls of their church.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, you know, it's the fire department is a certain amount of recreation, too, in the sense of I don't run anything there.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, as a person who just is not strong administratively anyway. It's nice to just show up and do your work.
Right.
And let somebody else fill out the paperwork.
Right. But I think
it love also, you, Chief.
This also, I think, is a good segue into one of you have taken up a role in ministry mm-hmm. As we have, as a nation, come out of a period of extreme affluence and become much more concerned and worried about our material welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you've made life choices that are modest at best.
Mm-hmm. All my cars have over 100,000 miles, and one of them has 200.
Right, right. And I think one of the ways in which people who don't have a religious background or don't have direct experience with evangelical Christian pastors, and mm-hmm. I'm going to use that term. It's a loaded term, but I'm using it as a friendly term.
Yeah,
because it is announcing the good news, and for you, that good news is a counter to the dominant story of materialism, mm-hmm. of a certain version of science.
Well, it's a word of hope. It's a word of possibility for transformation. It's a word. Evangelical is a word of, I think, empowerment and significance, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And you're aware, and so we should bring our listeners up on board. That is, the Smithsonian's exhibit was here at the local public library, for example. I was part of a faith group that rolled in there and had the opportunity, honestly, to just challenge some of the positions on that. Mm-hmm. We live in a time where we are moving rapidly away from, I think, a meaningful, and I use the word meaningful deliberately, for meaningful faith commitments being held by broad members of society. There's a lot of convenient faith commitments being held, but we're seeing a diminishment of faith commitments that involve faith community and a high level of commitment and involvement there. A lot of folks will say, "Well, I believe, and that's great," but they're not engaged with other faith community members on an ongoing routine basis, which is really where it's practiced and where it rubs your edges off a little bit.
Okay, so connection for me.
Well, so I approached the folks from the Smithsonian with a question. I'm hoping most of our listeners had the chance to get in and see the exhibit. It should be, if it's still there, it's only barely still there. Right, it was going to be in town for a month.
Right, but it'll be.
And it opened on November 28th. So
there are still activities.
Yeah, there's ongoing activities that'll be there, but the exhibit elements from the Smithsonian.
Early next week, if not the end of this
week.
Yeah,
this may be your last chance, so hop down to the library. But we had a chance to just talk with the staff from the Smithsonian a little bit, and I approached them with a really important question that's the one that we don't really discuss like we need to in our times, as transitional as they are. The headline on the exhibit is Origins: What Does It Mean to Be Human? And I challenged them in the sense of you're presenting this as science, and you're presenting this as the scientific thing. And this is what I said to the director of the exhibit. I said, but as soon as you ask the question about meaning, you've ceased doing science. And I love to think about these things. They, mm-hmm, they've been huge issues. Because they're huge issues, I think, for where our culture is going to go or not going to go. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I raised to him and I said, as soon as you ask, what does it mean? You're not doing science anymore.
Right.
You're telling the story. You're working through... You've stepped into metaphysics. You're not doing science anymore. You're in my camp.
Right, right.
And yet you've not brought anybody from the camp of the faith community in at the front of this exhibit, nor does the exhibit acknowledge the stories of origins, the other conversations of significance, and how that structures us as a society and as a world.
Right.
And I think the implications of this are really, really huge, and they're implications that have driven for me. I've loved being here in Ithaca. Coming here 15 years ago was just a gift to me, because here in Ithaca, you will find people who really want to talk and think about these things,
right,
and who are really actually most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, willing to go much deeper.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And explore presuppositions and assumptions. And I find that we as a culture are not willing to do that, and we've got to start. Because what does it mean to be human? What is the significance of a person? Mm-hmm. Is a gigantic question. The evangelical Christian faith answers that question both at the book of Genesis and in the life of Jesus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in the book of Genesis, man was created in a very particular way, with a very particular significance, right, to be the bearer of the image of God and to possess then an inherent dignity. No matter how we, with our life choices, trash that image and that dignity, it persists, and it makes each person extraordinarily sacred. And then God would send his son, which we just celebrated in the Christmas season, to come in to redeem that humanity after the fateful choices that have been made to corrupt and to destroy what we are, and to bring great damage and great stain upon the image. The sending of Jesus is God's action to respond to the damage and to the brokenness, and to reassert significance, and to reassert sanctity, and to reassert meaning, and to reassert value of the human being. And that's the worldview of the evangelical Christian, and that used to be the worldview of Western civilization, which drove so much science 200 years ago and 300 years ago, and really birthed so much of the basis of what science is now. There's a guy, I think his name is Ian Hutchinson out there, and he's the head of plasma physics at MIT, and I think he's got a book out there on the 10 great scientists of faith, and he goes back through Newton and Bacon and the people who really set the course of the disciplines that we're living in the fruits of today, including these radios that were coming through,
right, yeah, yeah.
And who were great people of faith, and who saw the significance and the dignity of humanity as something that should be seen in this world and pursued and pressed forward. And we've come now into this zone where faith is put to the side and science has become the new faith, but it can't live up to that.
Right, it's not its purpose.
Well, and the breaking, but too often that's the purpose that's asserted, and that was my challenge to the folks at the Smithsonian. Let me add too, before I forget about it, is that I'm actually in dialogue with one of the members of the Muslim community here, mm-hmm, and we're working together in concert with the public library going forward to bring this conversation from a Muslim Christian dialogue perspective, mm-hmm, of what does it mean to be human, and what is the significance of faith and science and those conversations together. So maybe you'll get a chance to make, we'll keep you posted when we get something scheduled, and you can let folks know when it's on. The public library will be announcing it.
Actually,
we're getting it pulled together.
I assume that you're talking about Mahmoud.
Yes,
Burton, because I just spoke with him last night, and this topic came up, and his observation was that as a matter of meaning, the exhibit was thin.
Yeah,
and this is, and the same language,
and yet the narratives that were being expressed were very narrowly expressed. And not leaving room for the other possible conversations and interpretations that were out there.
And so let me back up a little
bit,
because I've actually had I've had three of the people who came with the exhibit on the air show, on this show, in the past, and one of the issues that came up, which helped to clarify, mm-hmm, things tremendously for me, because I have As an ordained minister myself, I have a background in anthropology, both as a religious theological discipline, and a background from Cornell in anthropology as a humanities social science discipline. Mm-hmm. And the two function extremely differently in one critical point, mm-hmm, which is what you're getting at. Anthropology as a discipline, the members take a research orientation which looks at people as data.
Right.
And you have to and also people as and you want to have really solid handling of the data, and that works fine. Mm-hmm. But anthropologists themselves aren't very comfortable with having their personal practices challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas anthropology as a religious or spiritual matter is constantly questioning what is the role of the self in the universe? What is this relationship to God or to reality? Mm-hmm. And how do we manage impulses to do badly? or to cause pain, or to do evil? And how do we manage the other impulse, which is to do that which is of wonder or greatness or a tremendous goodness?
Yeah, and I think the trick within that picture is when you take people as data. And you try to apply the scientific picture to it. There's a lot of usefulness to that.
You find it tremendous interest.
There's a lot of usefulness and a lot of good stuff that can happen within that. But the risk is that you lose the parameters of what the limits of operating off data sets are. And so the conversation I want to have as a pastor in the community is when we start talking about meaning and we start talking about values and we start talking about priorities, as soon as you divorce those from a transcendent base, you suddenly lose any ability to discuss those things.
Right.
So I was reading the most recent issue of The New Yorker. Which just came in. In fact, this one's dated January 2nd. So even though we're taping several days before January 2nd, sure. That's how the magazine industry does it. And there's an article in there on Bach and Bach and his faith as it's expressed in the music that he's written and his passions, the St. John Passion, the St. Matthew Passion, those kinds of things. And yet he's also in a complicated period of history, a period that was complicated theologically, and there's always been a lot of discussion about his music, his theology, his person, and how those things all interact. But mostly he's been the analysis has been done from a secular anthropological perspective. And I thought the author of the article, after surveying a bunch of these books, made a very prescient observation that all these books on Bach and his stuff ask in different ways how we should approach works whose devotional intensity is alien to most modern listeners. That I loved, because he's saying we realize we don't get Bach.
Right.
Because Bach was set in a world in which the transcendent was prominent, values were scripturally derived and had saturated society to a certain degree, that was the water he swam in. The fish don't know that the water's wet, kind of a thing.
Right.
And he's like, we're now outside of that picture looking in, and we don't get it.
Right.
And so how do we transcend that? And I think we're at that place now in our cultural conversations where, on the one hand, we want to hold on to the Judeo-Christian system of values that people are significant, lives matter. People shouldn't be exploited. Take any one of your justice arguments that are in our headlines these days, be it Black Lives Matter, or be it human trafficking, or be it human rights and human rights abuses, or be it living wage conversations. Mm-hmm. Take any one of those; they're predicated on something. Each of them is predicated on the individual human being has value and is significant. And yet, as a culture, having jettisoned the predominant historic Christian worldview, which is kind of what the evangelical wing is preserving in this day and age, the scriptures as an authority and so on and so forth, jettisoning that base, we're now in a place of cognitive dissonance as a culture, where we want to argue these moral things, but we don't have a transcendent base in which to ground them. So how can somebody who doesn't have some strong religious conviction argue against human trafficking and the exploitation of people?
Right. Okay.
And make an argument that genuinely, truly, at its foundational level, makes sense.
Right.
Practically, sure, we can do ends justifies means arguments as the day is long. You know, if people can't have a moral wage, then we don't have this kind of economy or something like that. But the true values base is missing our society. I love those kinds of conversations. Right.
I guess what I and when I was in doctoral program in community and economic development planning and organizational behavior, one of the professors in organizational behavior said, "I challenge you to make an argument for a policy that is not on some fundamental level driven by efficiency." Mm-hmm. Almost all of science has to do mm-hmm. with parsimony. Mm-hmm. And precision
right.
and efficiency, and that helps you to take a given and to mm-hmm. put it in a particular place.
And my answer to him would have been this: I can make the argument not driven on efficiency, but driven on theology.
Well,
the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give Himself as a ransom for many is highly inefficient.
There are two ways out of that argument. You have named quite well one of them. The other one is the argument that most secularists are taking at this time, mm-hmm. which is through aesthetics,
mm-hmm.
and that is through what is meaningful or powerful in a larger conversation. They're willing to have the larger.
But why is that even a value? See, they still fail.
You're arguing with
to
me.
To come to the bottom.
They fail to come to your bottom, and what they have said to you is that you fail to come to their bottom, and we're kind of in a quagmire,
sure.
and we have to figure out how to have this conversation.
Well, the thing with aesthetics is beauty is now being held up as a new value. And if that's your new ultimate, then you've really just substituted a new religion.
Right, and this is where we will disagree.
But we're back to the religious context again.
That is right.
And
it allows science to be a mm-hmm. more predictable and limited yeah. sphere of activity, and yeah. puts aesthetics and religion more in focus. But we
and
don't
the
know how
is,
to go there.
Will science accept those boundaries? And I find that tends to not be the case. Dawkins and Hitchens and company want to argue meaning, but very quickly they leave the science reservation in their writings and head off into metaphysics without acknowledging that that's what they've done, and without acknowledging that they want to be the high priest of a new religion.
Right. And so what is... There are a couple of things that are required here, and I want to respond... There was a place when you at a program you were not at in the Human Origins conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
where
I had other commitments.
It opened up. There is a skull there that shows the signs. I think it's
right.
I don't know how many.
There were two skulls
well,
there.
It was the damaged one where the damage had healed, and this was
right.
hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say 1.8 million years, but I'm absolutely not.
I cannot remember the time scale.
Anyway,
gets our point.
The idea was that the teeth had been out of, the person had had no teeth for at least 5 years, mm-hmm. the man, and he was probably about 55 when he died. So he had managed to remain alive and fed by a community, and the reference was made, and it was made in kind of a flip sort of way, that this showed signs of caring and empathy. And that is, in a certain sense, is an over-interpretation. And I challenged the leader on that and said... it could also be that they were propping him up as the central authority figure, and his children were keeping him alive so that they could maintain power, mm-hmm. or all sorts of other things going on here.
A lot of other narratives could right. be spun around data,
right. Right.
and we have to stay with the data if we're going to be science.
Well, but the thing is you also, when you step out of the data, then you need to step into other people's background resources for what they find, where they find meaning. So mm-hmm. in this sense, I would say some Christians bring a heavy emphasis on scripture. Mm-hmm. Other Christians bring a heavy emphasis on the church as institution. Mm-hmm. Other mm-hmm. Christians bring heavy emphasis. But there are other sources where these conversations can go deeply from.
Right.
And I think what I experienced from the people from the Smithsonian was they didn't know how to start. They didn't know how to genuinely open the conversation because they didn't know if they could trust that they could facilitate it into that kind of depth. And that mm-hmm. is a human challenge. Now, for me,
yeah.
as a second year student in anthropology, second semester, I did a study of advisor-advisee relationships in the anthropology department at Cornell. And I asked, what are what is the satisfaction? What is the relationship between the advisors, anthropology professors, and their advisees? And I found that they're not very good in the first 2 years. They get better in the third and fourth, and they get close in the fourth. And in the first year in grad school, they're
trust
tight.
Builds.
But also, they have a common launching.
Yeah.
That student is going to get launched into grad school or into a profession, yep. and they need the recommendations, and they need a tight relationship. And when they arrive in as a new graduate student, they need a tight relationship to be working with somebody. But as they come out the other end, they get less satisfied, less happy with their relationship, and there's a greater distance that puts it. It's a perfect bell curve. But that kind of self-reflection of what we're doing is not part of what anthropologists do naturally.
Right.
And so as a second year undergrad, I'm asking uncomfortable questions
right.
that they don't want to answer. I'm not asking religious questions there,
right.
but I'm asking questions about meaning and relationship that are pushing buttons. And
I think within our culture, it's important then to be ready to ask those foundational presuppositional questions and accept the simple possibility that we're not going to come to an answer we're comfortable with, that we're not going to necessarily arrive where we've come to agreement necessarily.
Right.
But we've got to have the conversations, and I think it's very important to create safe space for those conversations. And there are a number of places, particularly in a science-heavy community like this one, where challenging the dominance of science as the be-all and end-all of the knowledge base is not safe. And so, you know, that conversation doesn't intimidate me, but there are many others for whom it's very uncomfortable. And I think for us as a community, I'd love to see us grow further in our ability to have the difficult conversations.
Right, and
be at peace having difficult conversations.
Well, and I'm going to frame it ever so slightly differently, not in content, but in tone.
Mm-hmm.
These conversations are going to be painful for everyone if they are mm-hmm. serious yeah. and deep and searching.
Mm-hmm.
If we take each other seriously. If we don't take each other seriously, they will be trite, petty, and we'll have these yeah. little blow-ups.
Yeah.
But the level of personal pain and and questioning and challenge that we're going to be giving each other is going to be like a marital fight.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be.
Well, no, and I'm not. I'm not talking.
I want to shift gears on that a little because I really do want to.
I want to finish my.
Yeah,
thought
okay,
first.
Go for that.
They are like a marital disagreement where you begin to question the very ties that hold you. I'm not talking about fireworks here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about just, what are we here for? What are we doing? Why does it matter? How do we communicate? We're working out of different texts, mm-hmm. different traditions, different yeah. sources of meaning, different analytical standards, and we're trying to understand each other.
Well, and there may be some places where there's going to have to just be some agree to disagree stuff, but I think a lot of times the evangelical community gets portrayed as doctrinaire and unthinking and knee-jerk and unwilling to, in good faith, embrace those conversations, and yet the simple truth is pastoral ministry is by nature very messy. You know, in pastoral ministry, we are all declaring something that we aspire to in which none of us meets. That's the nature of ministry. That's the nature of the faith.
Right. But,
and so we're used to, in evangelicalism, and I really want to throw the door open that we're very open to these conversations because we're used to in our own house the conversations yeah. unresolved. We're used to having the conversations coming out messy about life and living in those things.
Right.
And we're used to having sometimes to say the hard things because we love the other right. person and we have to touch on those bases.
And we have as scientists have their apologists, which beat evangelicals over the head, as well as all other religions, evangelicals mm-hmm. had their apologists in the 19th and 20th century
sure.
who beat everybody else up. And we have yeah. this, and there's reality to these stereotypes,
yeah.
but I've worked across these differences.
Yeah.
And if we can get past the fear, to this space. Mm-hmm. I have found openness, yeah. and I have found equal amounts of ignorance across the board.
Well, and but the other side, not just getting past the fear, but also I think there's a need at times to get past the hubris that I have the corner on the truth and see it all for what it all is, and if you don't agree with me, well, then a pox on your house. I have nothing left to say. Sometimes I think that posture on all sides and in many That's spheres exactly is right. taken.
That is exactly right.
And in that moment, we've lost where we started, which is the dignity, the sanctity, the value, and the preciousness of the person across the table, which is the weakness of our modern communications right. and social media, because you can transmit without having to think about who's on the receiving end. And that's where the tragedy of our day rests.
Exactly. And that's why I do this show, is to get the mm-hmm. voices out and to try to frame them in ways that people mm-hmm. who couldn't have heard can hear.
Yeah. So if you know of an evangelical Christian, take them out for coffee and ask them how they're doing. Yeah. You know, because
and
my brothers and sisters in the church, if you're packing up and getting ready to go to church today, please remember that you know a number of other people who you need to know what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and need to affirm their significance in life and value in life as well. And they may very much need that.
And it happens where we talk about where we struggle and where we have hurt ourselves and others, and where others have hurt us.
Yeah.
And that is where the conversation gets real across these differences.
Yeah.
Steve, it is wonderful to get to know you.
Good to be with you.
And we're going to, which one do you want to close with? The higher ed
Maynard
or with
Ferguson.
Maynard Ferguson?
Let's just go big.
Okay. And you want to say anything about this one?
Yeah. You know, like I said, I had the experience in high school and I've just always loved the brass.
Oops.
So we'll just run up the horn, and this was jazz band material from my high school days.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay Report.